Imam, this. Tuam, your good self. Adatishtasra. Just remain. Purim, in the city. Navamukim, with nine gates. Vivo, O my Lord. Maya, by me. Upanitan, arranged. Grinanaka, taking. Kamavogan, the materials for sense gratification. Shatam, a hundred. Samaha, years. The translation. My dear Lord, I have just arranged the city of nine gates for you so that you can have all kinds of sense gratification. You may live here for 100 years, and everything for your sense gratification will be supplied. So you can repeat, my dear Lord. I've just arranged the city of nine gates for you so that you can have all kinds of sense gratification. You may live here for 100 years. And everything for your sense gratification will be supplied. So purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Dharamartha Kama Mokshanam Dhara Samprapti Hetavaha. The wife is the cause of all kinds of success in religion, economic development, sense gratification, and ultimately salvation. When one accepts a wife, it is to be understood that he is being helped in his progressive march toward liberation. In the beginning of life, a person is trained as a brahmachari and then is allowed to marry a suitable girl and become a householder. If one is thoroughly trained in household life, he finds all facilities for human life, eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. Everything is there if it is executed according to regulative principles. So, Imam Tvam Adatishtasva Purim Navamukim Vipo Mayopanitam Grindana Kamabogansitam Samaha. So, Om Ganat Mirandasha Gananjana Shlakaya Chakshur Unmiritam Yena Tasmai Shigrave Namaha. So this is not exactly the type of verse you would give to someone who is wanting to take sannyas. Because actually, probably makes it very clear that if one has what's called a dharma putni, that's an interesting, putni means wife, of course, dharma, according to dharma, if one has a dharma putni or a religious wife, or you're religiously wed, then you can have all these different things that you want. Dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. Pretty good. That means religious life, religious principles, economic development, sense gratification, and then you get liberation. So what's the problem? So I'll speak about it from that perspective, although it's not something I normally talk about in class. So why is it that if someone is properly married, we're talking about a householder now, if a man is properly married, he gets these four different things. Let's start with dharma. Dharma, of course, means religious principles, but in this particular context, it indicates more that the karmakanja religious principles. In other words, different sacrifices, different ritualistic performances like that. And I'll give you an example. In the Ramayana, You have Lord Ramchandra, he wanted to perform the Ashvamedha sacrifice. Ashvamedha sacrifice is a sacrifice in which a horse wanders everywhere, and anyone who stops the horse, horse, of course, has a little challenge thing on him, says that you cannot stop me. If anybody stops me, you can be fought by the king. So anybody who stops the horse is fought by the king's soldiers, and the horse continues, and finally the horse ends up back at the sacrifice, and then the horse is sacrificed, and the horse is rejuvenated or given a new body when it's sacrificed. So that's called an Ashvamedha sacrifice. So in order for that Ashvamedha sacrifice to be performed, it's like a Karmakanja sacrifice. In order for it to be performed, I mean, it also can be performed by devotees for the purpose of elevating society if someone happens to be a Kshatriya. It's a Kshatriya Dharma sacrifice. One has to have one's lawfully wedded wife next to them. That's part of the procedure. In fact, it's said that in the performance of ritualistic duties, one's wife should always be there, one's Brahmin at least. I remember in the early days of the movement, when the temple presidents were all married and everything like that, they were doing the sacrifice, they'd always have their wife right next to them while they were doing the sacrifice. That's very interesting. It should be done. So, anyway, so there was a dilemma. A big dilemma when Lord Ram wanted to perform the sacrifice, and the big dilemma was that his wife wasn't there. Sita Devi wasn't there, because previously she had been exiled because the citizens of Ayodhya had complained, you know, why has Lord Ram accepted this woman? Who knows whether she's actually chaste or not? They were actually quite offensive to Sita Devi. So who knows if this woman is actually chaste? So this Lord Ram is just henpecked. And Lord Ram understood they wouldn't respect him properly as the king, because the king has to go above and beyond the call of duty to maintain his stature so people will respect him. In other words, he has to be completely transparent, and even more than transparent. He has to be completely free from any sort of spots or perceived spots, or else he won't be able to do his duties. Now, people are not going to listen, because it's traditionally, the king's authority over the citizens was based upon love and trust. It wasn't based so much upon the stick, except for, you know, the Shudras, of course, they always needed the stick. So Lord Ram was caught in the horns of a dilemma. You know, I can't bring Sita back, but I have to do this sacrifice, so what am I going to do? So eventually, he arrived at what we call a win-win, which means he made a statue of Sita Devi. And he seated that statue right by the sacrifice, and then he did his little sacrifice at that particular point. So, I mean, that's a big reason why one needs a wife if one's a grahasta. Of course, grahasta means for the wife. Which is actually funny. So, but if one's in that ashram, So there's other reasons, too, why it's very important for householders to have a wife, you know. Or other reasons why a wife brings dharma. Another reason is the children. There's this story in the Mahabharata about this person, Jaratkaru. I've told this story before. Jaratkaru was brahmachari, and he was wandering through the forest and very happy in his brahmachari life. Nobody is as free as me, jai, haribol. You know, no entanglement. Then he ran into his ancestors, who were hanging over a hole in the ground, a ditch, and I think they were held by a rope upside. They were upside down, and a rat or a mouse was eating the rope, so they were ready to fall. And so he came across these people. He didn't know that they were his ancestors. And he asked them, you know, why are you hanging like that? I mean, what's the problem? And his ancestors, who he didn't know were his ancestors, said, the reason is that our descendant has not had any children. And because he hasn't had any children, there's no one to perform the pindar ceremony. Because the children are called generally putra, those who save their ancestors from hell. And the pindar ceremony is basically that, you know, it's a shraddha ceremony, you offer food to the ancestors. I mean, nowadays it's become a little polluted in India. They even offer meat to their ancestors. You seen it? I've seen that in India. You know, they offer meat. You seen that, right? Yeah, but previously it was just vegetarian food. And then they would give the remnants to the brahmanas, you know, the best of the brahmanas after. They would feed the brahmanas after they would do that. So in the past, we've gone to some shraddha ceremonies. Especially in South India, they do this all the time. On the anniversary of their ancestors' death or their father's death or like that, that they would invite us over and they would feed us. They would feed us all sorts of course, in South India, generally yogurt and things like that. Yogurt and rice. That's traditional. In North India, it's chapatis. So, anyways, and sweets. You know, obviously there's sweets offered to the forefathers because they don't want the forefathers to be too austere. So there's this shraddha ceremony offered by the putras, by the sons or the grandsons or whatever. That's why it's very important. So anyway, getting back to the story, so this Jarakaru, he saw these people hanging over the ditch, and they said, you know, our progeny, or the people who are on the planet now, who are come from us, come from our family line. They're not having children, so there's not going to be any. There's not going to be any shraddha ceremony. And so Jarakaru asked them, you know, who are you talking about? And they said, well, we're talking about a person named Jarakaru. And Jarakaru said, ooh, that's me, and I'm a brahmachari. And so he was also caught in the horns of a dilemma. He said, you know, I don't want to get married, so much entanglement and all that other nonsense. But, you know, I have this duty. You know, so this is a karmakanya duty. It's not actually a devotional duty, just to clue you all in. Because if one chants Hare Krishna and is a devotee of Krishna, he liberates all of his ancestors and even future generations and, you know, that's vertical, and then even parallel. Parallel means like people related to him now, like his cousins, his second cousins, third cousins. You know, it goes like, sometimes it's described as ten directions in each, you know, horizontal and vertically. Sometimes it's described as 100. I mean, there's different descriptions. But anyway, he doesn't need to do these ceremonies. We don't find that Prabhupada, when he took sannyas, did any of the ceremonies for his ancestors. So, Jarakaru, he was thinking, you know, I have this duty I have to perform. However, I want to be a brahmachari. What the hell is going on? So he thought, well, I'll make a deal with these people. So really, I don't have to get married. He had a little trick up his sleeve. He said, look, all right, I will get married, but only if I can find someone with the name Jarakaru, same name as me. And he's thinking, you know, it's a male name. He's not going to find someone with the same name as himself, right? I mean, very difficult. It's just like if your name was Bob, and you said, I'm only going to get married if I can find a girl with the name Bob. Well, nowadays, plenty of girls with the name Bob. So it'd be kind of weird. So he just thought, you know, I got it made. You know, it's a trick thing. Like sometimes the demons try to trick the Lord Brahma when they're asking for benediction, not... I don't want to be killed in the daytime or nighttime by man or beast. So he thought, you know, it's not going to happen. So he went away and he was wandering in the forest, real happy like that. I'm not going to have to get married, thank God. And then finally he just called out one day, you know, if anyone's called Jarakaru, I'm supposed to get married to you. And then this is your last chance. You know, no more chances. You know, I'm just a little too old for this business now. And so what happened is that there was this this snake race, which it actually was in danger, or would be in danger, because Maharaj Janamajaya, the son of Maharaj Parikshit, was going to perform this Sarpa Yajna. That means a sacrifice in which you sacrifice the snakes. And that means all the snakes were going to go into the fire, the sacrificial fire. And so there had to be someone who would save the snakes. And so the Suki and the other snakes planned it out, and they understood that this Jaratkara was supposed to have a son who would save the snakes. And so they understood they had to. He had to name his sister. His sister's name was also Jaratkara, and give her to the sage Jaratkara. You understand? So what happened is Jaratkara was crying out, "This is your last chance. You know, hey, if there's not a girl named Jaratkara, forget it. You know, I'm just going to live happy for the rest of my life." So what happened is that Vasuki came forward with his sister. Vasuki is also one of the nice snakes. I mean, there's several nice snakes. It's not that all snakes are bad. Sesha is also a good guy. Mm-hmm. Balaram. So Vasuki, he's also very nice. And so they brought him, Jaratkara, his sister, forward. And he said, "Here's my sister. Got to marry her." And then, but Jaratkara, the man, he was thinking, you know, this is too much. I almost got out of it. Let me make some arrangements so I can get out of it sooner, even though I'm stuck now. So he said, this is a prenuptial agreement, that if she ever says anything disagreeable to me, I'm going to leave her immediately. Is this all right? And so Vasuki said, "All right, I guess that's the deal, you know. A deal is a deal." So so there was the marriage, and she was, of course, very submissive because she didn't want to say anything disagreeable to him because her husband would leave immediately. Can you imagine that? That's something like the opposite of Shantanu's marriage, right? Where Shantanu married Gangadevi, and Gangadevi said that if he ever disagrees with me, if you ever disagree with me, I'm leaving. And so she proceeded to throw all of her kids into the river up until the point they got the eighth one, which was Bhishma. So Jaratkara and his wife, they were living happy. You know, such a submissive wife. You know, she had to keep a bandage on her mouth all the time. Every man would like that. Someone who doesn't talk back. Always smiles. Like that would be an ideal marriage. Anyway, so what happened is that one day, she never did talk back. She was actually quite a nice snake lady. So one day, it came time for him to do his sanja ceremony. Sanja means like at different times of the day, there's three sanjas, tree sanja. That means morning, noon, and evening when you do your Gayatri. So it was time for him to do his evening Gayatri and different Brahminical things. Brahmins do a lot of things in the evening, they don't just sit and chant Gayatri for 3 minutes and then it's all over. But they, you know, there's all sorts of rituals and fire. They keep a fire burning in their house all the time. There's actually, traditional Brahmins would always keep a fire burning, the ritualistic fire. So what happened is that he was sleeping. And she was thinking, you know, my husband's sleeping. I don't want him to violate his Brahminical vows. But she was thinking, if I wake him up, he's going to be so grouchy. You know, sometimes it's like that. You definitely don't want to deal with someone when they just wake up. You know, you got to be really careful because they're just like, anyway, they can either be spaced out or grouchy. And so she did that. She thought, well, it's a higher principle. I got to wake him up, you know. And she woke him up and said, "Dear, wake up. Wake up, sweetie." You know, she didn't just like say, "Get up, you bum. It's time for the sacrifice." She was kind and sweet at it. But still, he was so grouchy when he got up that he said, I'm out of here. You did something that aggravated me. He said, I was just trying to protect your religious principles. Don't leave me. And he said, forget it. No, he was just basically looking for an excuse. You know, the first opportunity, you know, sometimes you're really looking for an excuse to do something, and you just take the first little opportunity. And she said, but we're supposed to have a kid that's supposed to save the snake dynasty. And he said, you know, Ashtagat, you know, that's, so it will be. And she was pregnant, and then she gave birth a little while later to this Ashtagat. And this Ashtagat, this is a story of the Mahabharata, this Ashtagat went in the middle of Janmanjaya's snake sacrifice, and similar to the Vamanadev story, actually, that Vamanadev was asked, you know, basically, what do you want? He took 3 steps of land, he took everything, and, you know, basically stopped Bali Maharaj from taking control of the universe. In the same way, Ashtagat was received very nicely, and Janmanjaya said, what do you want? He said, stop the sacrifice. And at that point, they were just ready to throw Takshaka and Indra into the fire, because they had immolated many other serpents. And Takshaka was taking shelter of Indra. And so the Brahmanas were saying the mantra, let Takshaka and his protector, Indra, go into the fire. Takshaka, of course, is the snake bird that bit Maharaj Pariksit. You know, when he bit him, he just like burst into flames and had instant cremation. So they just had said that, and then Indra and Takshaka were just like in the air, hovering, you know, just like ready to enter into the fire when Ashtaka requested that of Maharaj Janmanjaya, and then the Brahmana just said, stop. And so we saved the snake race. So, anyway, so. The reason I'm telling that story is that that's another reason why dharma is upheld in household life. I mean, the ritualistic dharma. We're talking about ritualistic dharma. Of course, Krishna does say in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, sarva dharma prajaja mam ekam sharanam praja. That, and was it Madhavendra Puri said, I think it was Madhavendra Puri who said, My obeisances or my respects to my forefathers and demigods and everything, I'm not able to, you know, do all these ritualistic ceremonies, but I've taken shelter of Krishna. Too bad. So, I'm not just paraphrasing what he said. So please forgive me, he said. Please forgive me. So, obviously, you know, if one takes up devotional service, one doesn't have to worry about all these different dharmic things. One has the ultimate dharma, which is swadharma. Swadharma means one's own spiritual self-dharma, not the dharma of ritualistic karmakanda practices. All right, so that's dharma. So I thought I said I was going to explain how being with one's wife helps one with dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. So as far as artha is concerned, artha means what you want or economic development. Prabhupada said, quoting an English economist, that sex attraction is the root or the what the impetus, I'm paraphrasing, for economic development. Because without, you know, married life, I mean, most men really wouldn't want to get a job. you know, what are you going to get a job for? I mean, the men would be bums, basically, unless they were Krishna conscious. You know, the point is, if someone's Krishna conscious, it's a different thing. But, you know, if there's not a wife there telling you to get to work, and, you know, you have so many necessities, and she needs clothes, and she needs jewelry, right? And new saris, she has to go to the hairdresser, and all these things. It costs money. I mean, otherwise, why... You know, why spend the money? I mean, maybe you want a computer. You can make a little money to buy a computer or an iPad or something. But otherwise, what's the need of it, right? What's the need of economic development? And so basically, if people weren't Krishna conscious or, you know, weren't engaged in devotional service and they didn't have the impetus of household life, there'd be millions of bums. Everybody would be on food stamps. Not saying that everybody was on food stamps is a bum. But you know, you'd have people who are capable of working, and you wouldn't have any of these big buildings here, you know, the skyscrapers or anything, basically. It'd just be like jungles. Just like jungles. And the men would be like cavemen, you know, just dragging taking the women by their hair and dragging them into caves and not taking responsibility. So economic development also comes from the household life. Prabhupada said that. So that's dharma, artha. And then kama certainly comes from household life because the wife pleases the husband in different ways. I mean, there's the... I mean, not only the sex life, but there's also the food, which is very important. There's even one song during the 1960s, you know, that you should find someone, even if she's ugly, you should find someone who cooks if you want to be happy for the rest of your life, who cooks nicely. Because the wife doesn't cook. So the wife satisfies the husband with nice food, you know, and sweet words, and also social life. What would be the social life without the wife? Like, I mean, you have to go to all these different social gatherings. You have the marriages of your grandchildren, the marriages of your nephews. I mean, I know I deal with people from India all the time, and it's amazing how many social performances they have. I mean, I'm just shocked. Every time someone who's like a third cousin or a fifth cousin gets married, they fly all over the world spending tens of thousands or millions of dollars to attend these ceremonies, isn't it? But if you weren't married, I mean, what would you do? You just chant Hare Krishna. But and then all the ceremonies, and then you're just talking, God knows what they talk about. How is little Sonia doing, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever the girl's name is. I haven't seen my nephews in so many years. I mean, also in the West, we also have ceremonies like that, too, you know, the social ceremonies, and you meet, I haven't seen you for years. You've really grown. People say like that? Well, I remember you when you were a little kid. Wow, you're an adult now. How's medical school going? You know, so you have all these things called gramya katha. Basically, you're just speaking about things that have absolutely no ultimate significance. So in other words, that's the kama. You get the enjoyment, the social life. And, of course, women like to dress up nicely for these social occasions with their best... in marriages, they have this thing right before the marriage called the puti bhoj. Heard of this before? That means... Bhoj, of course, means to eat. It means love feast, basically, in English. Love feast, where the women all dress up, you know, just like their finest. And they're just like, it's like a fashion show, basically. One time I was visiting someone's house, and there was a priti bhoj the next day. And the women didn't come out. You know, I was taking prasadam. But the women didn't come out. I said, why isn't your wife or anyone coming out? Because they were all hiding because they were dressed up like deities. And they didn't want me to see them. You know, finally I looked in the back room and there were all these deities there, you know, in human bodies. But, you know, all the jewelry and everything like that. What's happening here? And they said, it's a pretty bhoj tonight. And I looked in the window of the priti bhoj was taking place, and they were all going like that, showing off their clothes. You seen that, the priti bhoj? I'm sure you've seen, yeah. And so it doesn't matter who's getting married, it's just an opportunity for people to show off their clothes. And So there's different types of kama. So that's kama, you know, enjoyment.
like that. And, you know, it's necessary.
It just keeps
people. I mean, all these things are dharmic in the sense that they keep people stable. You know, at least you have something to do so you're not just like a bum. And then finally, moksha. And that's an interesting thing. You know, dharma, artha, kama, moksha comes from household life or Vedic household life. Why? Because the man and the woman have gotten an opportunity to do their things dharmically. You know, dharma, artha, and kama. Dharmically, so they haven't performed any sinful activities if they're following the dharma shastras. And so because of that, they're able to actually later on focus on liberation. And then they've enjoyed themselves throughout their lives, and they've seen the futility, hopefully, of enjoying them, of attempting to enjoy themselves. I mean, how many outfits has the woman worn? How many shoes has she bought throughout her life, isn't it? So many shoes, so much Mangal Sutra she's worn. I mean, all these things, are just, as you've seen, these things haven't brought me happiness. You know, intelligent person, I mean, that's why people joined the movement. One reason in the 1960s when Prabhupada came, because in America, because people had done everything before. You know, the Americans, Prabhupada said the Americans had tried out all these means of sense gratification and they were basically disappointed. And so, and that's really what household life is, that you try out things, you know, your economic development, you've bought so many cars, paid so many mortgages off, gone to so many pretty bhojas, you know, eaten so many meals, and you're still not happy. Or not blissful, at least. And then you realize, hey, maybe we've been missing something. And then so you go for moksha, for liberation from this material world. So anyway, so this is why the proper household life and the Vedic culture brings one to dharma, artha, kama, and moksha. But it must be executed according to the regulative principles, as Srila Prabhupada says here. And then, but one can do this for 100 years. So any questions or comments? We have about 2 or 3 minutes left. Yeah.
Maharaj, in Bhagavatam, when Dakshaparvati was having a conversation with Narada Muni, when Narada Muni converted all of his sons to Brahmachari,
yeah,
Dakshya Prajapati also gives the same argument to Narada Muni, saying that, you know, one has to go through Dharma, Artha, Kama. But in the purport, actually, Prabhupada expresses his disagreement.
Yeah.
Saying that by experiencing miseries, one cannot renounce. He says something like Samsara Vairagya, that the desire for renunciation comes for a moment, but next
it goes away, yeah.
That's true.
But that's true. But one can actually, if one is intelligent, one can examine the things. We're not talking about just desires. One can examine his experiences throughout his life and see, I tried this, 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 and that, and it hasn't brought me happiness. And so, therefore, I should take. But it's not that actual renunciation comes from experience in the material world. But an impetus for renunciation comes. Impetus means one's realization from examining one's past. These things didn't bring me happiness. So that's there. And also, if one follows the Vedic system, like from the grahastha life, automatically the vanaprastha life comes. And in the vanaprastha life, one is enjoined, one is, by duty, one is forced to engage in activities of renunciation. Like that. So, I mean, Prabhupada also in other places does sort of approve what Dacha was saying. You know, he does. It's not that that's only one place where Prabhupada talks about that. But in other places, you know, for most people, they do have to go through these different stages. And if they don't go through those different stages, then their renunciation may not be fully realized or fully complete. As we've seen in our society, where people prematurely took up a renounced order of life and they didn't go through the stages, they felt that they were missing something. So sometimes that happens too. So there's two sides to that. But it is absolutely a fact that the more you enjoy, it's not that you become more renounced by enjoying more or attempting to enjoy more. However, you can look back and intelligently examine and see how all your attempts at enjoyment were futile. And that will be an impetus for you to take up bhakti. And if one takes up bhakti immediately, Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojita, Janayati Asuvai Ragyam, Ganamiyachada Haitukam, then renunciation arises from the process of bhakti. But one really has to take up bhakti, not just call himself a member of the Krishna conscious movement. One has to be absorbed in Krishna's name, Krishna's pastimes, Krishna's form, Krishna's qualities, the holy Dham. You have to, your mind has to be absorbed. So, Manak Krishna Padara Vindiyo. Otherwise, renunciation will not fully manifest itself. These are different aspects to this discussion. Okay, all glories to His divine grace. Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Ki Jai.